In 2006, Tavis Smiley, along with a team of esteemed contributors, laid out a national plan of action to address the 10 most crucial issues facing African Americans. The Covenant, which became a number one New York Times bestseller, ran the gamut from health care to criminal justice, affordable housing to education, voting rights to racial divides. But a decade later, black men still fall to police bullets and brutality. Black women still die from preventable diseases. Black children still struggle to get a high-quality education. The digital divide and environmental inequality persist, and American cities from Ferguson to Baltimore burn with frustration. In short, the last decade has seen the evaporation of black wealth, with black fellow citizens having lost ground in nearly every leading economic category. And so, in his new book, The Covenant with Black America, 10 years later, Tavis Smiley presents the original action plan alongside new data from the Indiana University School of Public and Environmental Affairs to underscore missed opportunities and the work that remains to be done. Tavis Smiley is currently the host of the late-night television talk show Tavis Smiley on PBS, as well as the Tavis Smiley Show from Public Radio International, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Tavis Smiley back to the roundtable. Sir, good morning, and thank you very much for being with us. Good to have you back.
Joe, likewise. Good to be back. Thanks for the opportunity, my friend.
Thank you very much for being here. How did this project come about 10 years ago?
In 2005, as part of my annual State of the Black Union Symposium, your audience may recall that for about a dozen years, every year, around the first part of the year, we would have this national conversation. It would be on C-SPAN all day on a Saturday. We brought together the thought leaders, opinion makers, influencers, some of the brightest and best minds in Black America to talk about how to advance on the issues that were quite frankly tripping Black America up. So we did that conversation every year, start of the year, for 12 years. In 2005, we announced we were going to put together a book that really laid out the top 10 critical issues to Black Americans and what could be done for us to make some progress to advance on those issues. Later that year, Katrina happened in New Orleans, and so in early 2006, the book got out, and it went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, stayed there for many weeks. It laid out the top 10 issues of critical importance to Black folk, from education to the economy to the environment, to the digital divide, to reclaiming our democracy, to criminal justice reform. All the 10 issues that are most important to Black folk were covered in the book with how we could make some progress. And here we are 10 years later on the eve of another presidential election season, and the anniversary, of course, begged for us to look at the book and see what had happened over the last 10 years. And I am sad to report, pains me to tell you, Joe, that it is not a pretty picture.
Do you think you saw progress after the initial book and the conversations and then went backwards, or did you just never see the progress materialize at all?
Movements in this country are very rare. Movements are very rare, and I think that what typically happens is when they do come around in our lifetimes, it starts with a moment. The moment builds momentum, and the momentum turns into a movement if you're lucky. I call them the three M's: moment, momentum, and then movement. We had not gotten to the movement phase, but the momentum was surely there. The book had gone to number one, stayed there for many, many weeks. Everybody in Black America seemed to have a copy of it. I was on tour, it seemed like, for 3 months. I couldn't get off the road because people wanted to continue conversations. There were organizations that started as a result of the Covenant. We put out a second book called The Covenant in Action that detailed all of the actions that people were taking based upon how they were inspired and empowered by the first book, The Covenant. And there were two presidential debates around The Covenant. The book came out in 2006, as I said earlier. In 2007, for the first time in the history of this country, there were two presidential debates live in prime time, both on PBS. I moderated them, where the candidates were being asked exclusively about black issues. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, even John Edwards, all those Democrats showed up at Howard University in D.C. All the Republicans came to Morgan State in Baltimore, two primetime debates with presidential candidates talking about the state of Black America, because the book was just that profound and was having that sort of impact in 2006. Well, fast forward 2 years, Obama shows up as a black candidate, wins the White House, and a lot of black people, I think, were caught up in the symbolism and didn't get around to the substance. there was too much deference to the president on the part of Black America and too much indifference to him by the Republican obstructionist. And so we look up 10 years later, and sad to report, Black America, a decade later, has lost ground, Joe, in every major economic category, in every leading economic category over the last 10 years, we have lost ground.
I realize this to be a difficult question to answer because of its many facets and the porous nature of it. But because we have an African-American president who, at least from my opinion, seems to be very interested in the substance of what you just mentioned, was there a sense that substance would be listened to? Or instead, did it show an inherent racism that is present in this country that rebelled against what he was looking to do?
Can I take both?
Absolutely.
I feel like saying both for 500, Alex. I think the answer is both. Clearly, there is an indifference, and as I said earlier, there has been an obstruction. Those who thought that the mere election of a Black president was going to usher us into this sort of post-racial society, that didn't quite happen. America, I'd like to think, is less racist for him having been elected, but we're not post-racial. And I can't even wholly own my first point because the data that I'm reading from the Pew Research Center says that Americans are still just as distraught about the race question in this country as they were when he took office. In some parts of the country, even they feel worse now about the race question than they did when he was elected in 2008. So we haven't made progress on that. Racism is still the most intractable issue in this country. That's what the data, I think, points up. But there were people, certainly in the Black community and more broadly in the progressive community, to your first part of your question, Joe, who I think kind of green screened him. That's a TV term. You know what green screen is, of course, but we projected our thoughts and our ideals and our hopes and aspirations and our agenda onto him. And I'm not sure Obama was ever progressive enough to begin with to even attempt to get that done. But people put all of that on him. And again, 10 years later, where Black folk are concerned, we come up short.
Tavis Smiley is our guest. The new book is The Covenant with Black America, 10 Years Later. When you think of what could have been done, and I assume that this, in reading the book, I get the sense, obviously, and you address this, that there were key moments where we failed to do things that we certainly could have done things.
Right.
And it seems that just in the last 2-3 years, police violence is certainly one aspect of this question, where we could have taken great... We could have used that moment to ultimately lead to the momentum and the movement that you talked about.
Yeah, there are many moments missed, and I guess if there were a subtext to the text, it would be missed opportunities. We've missed so many opportunities, and I'm so grateful to have had the involvement of the Indiana University School of Public and Environmental Affairs, because all the professors and the academics there did the research in all of these various disciplines and areas to give us the data on these 10 covenants about what's happened or not happened over the last 10 years. So this book is fact-based, it's data-based, it's not Tavis's conjecture. I compiled and edited it based upon the data that was put in front of me from the experts in the various fields. That said, they point out in their research that there were so many missed opportunities. Now, thankfully, there's still work that can be done. There's still ideas that can be implemented, and there are pockets of poverty. For example, digital divide. In the digital divide, you know, the gulf is no longer, Joe, race-based. It's now class-based. In other words, every Black person basically has access to a smartphone now. So just based on that factoid alone, the divide has shrunk because we all have access to smartphones and you can connect to the Internet. But it's class-based, the divide is, because most Black folk can still not afford a computer and a printer in their home. There's only so much homework you can get done on an iPhone. As nice as it might be, so that the divide is class-based again and not race-based, but the divide still exists. And so there are pockets of poverty. The Obamacare got passed, but most of the provisions haven't kicked in yet. Most importantly, that first provision, the most critical one, I think, pre-existing conditions, many of those provisions haven't kicked in yet, so the health of Black people has not been impacted by it, even though it passed, number one. And number two, the Obamacare, you know, didn't do anything about health disparities, and so that black women still die disproportionately from preventable diseases. And so pockets of poverty, but again, by and large, not much progress made over the last 10 years. This is not a skill problem. It's a will problem. Do we have the will to do it? Are we going to continue being deferential to politicians and others?
You spoke a moment ago about the digital divide and the impact that has on black children in education. But obviously, black children, just the struggle for them to get a high quality education has been a problem for a very long time in and of itself.
Indeed. And some of these problems, I said most of these problems, practically all of them, you know, existed prior to Obama's election. So I've not tried in this text to lay the blame at his feet. His name is barely mentioned in the text because, again, it's not about him. It's about the state of black America and where we are, you know, 10 years later. So let me be clear on your education question and, for that matter, on all the other issues in the book. The question to my mind, Joe, is not how do black folk stand today? How do we fare today as compared to 50 or 100 years ago? Now, if that's the question, clearly there's been progress that's been made. That's not the question, though. The question is, how do black folk today stack up against white folk today? How do we stack up in real time, not comparative to 50 years ago? And in real time, that's where you see that we're losing ground. Black wealth has evaporated in the last 10 years. And all these other categories, you know, ground has been lost. You mentioned the police issue. I mean, how are the historians, I sometimes think about this, Joe, how are the historians going to juxtapose, how are they going to grapple with the data that in the era of the first black president, the bottom fell out for black America politically, socially, and economically? How are they going to say, and how are they going to juxtapose that in the era of the first black president, black boys and black men were being shot dead in the streets and that cops were getting away with it? How are they going to explain that in the era of the first black president, it took a Black Lives Matter movement of young black people to even get the president's attention, much less everybody else's attention, on the sanctity and the dignity and the humanity of black life? I mean, those are going to be hard things to square, I think, in the years to come.
Let me ask some very specific questions about what you just said. Number one, how much blame do you believe at this point in calendar year 2016 falls at the feet of the President of the United States?
It's a very good question to be answered the best way and the most honest way I can, not to walk around it. The question about Barack Obama on these issues that we're discussing is going to be, was he obstructed or did he not try hard enough? And you can predict my answer.
Both. Yeah.
He was obstructed and he didn't try hard enough. That's it.
So do you believe that, because I find what we hear in this current cycle of a political contest to be troubling, and I'm certainly not alone in that. And I ask the question somewhat cautiously because I and I'm sure you do all the time on your programs where people will say you talk about Donald Trump too much, but when you have a candidate who is very outspoken and people react to that. Meanwhile, a ballot has not been cast yet, and yet we hear that this man is at the front of the polls. So we take that information for what it is worth. But we hear someone who is very outspoken on a wide range of issues, and people, it almost gives them a license to believe even more far-fetched things than he has said. Does that not hurt the progress and the movement of which you outline in the book?
Yes and no. Yes, because it's antithetical to the direction that I'm trying to take the country and that you want the country to move in. On the other hand, sometimes you have to have something that is so outlandish, that is so out of the ordinary, that is so irascible in its content. So out of context and content in its approach that it almost becomes laughable. Now, we have not arrived at that point yet where Mr. Trump is concerned. He is obviously still polling quite well. But sometimes to get your mooring straight, to get your bearing straight, you got to come up against, you know, something that bizarre. And then maybe it's the bizarre that brings you back to reality. You know, it's like, you know, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's like I have too many friends and I've interviewed too many people who were drug addicts. And the thing that brought them back was something really crazy and stupid that they did or came upon. Like, you know what? I can't live this way anymore. So maybe it's going to take us swinging so far out to get our moorings and get our bearings straight again. And maybe that's, you know, I'm at least hopeful that we will come to our senses about this. But at the end of the day, when you put these issues laid out in this text in front of Donald Trump, or for that matter, in front of Hillary Clinton, they both have some explaining to do. Trump's got some explaining to do based upon, you know, the positions that he's taken thus far. And Mrs. Clinton has some explaining to do based upon the things that her husband did. Some of those things of which, as you know, he's already apologized for. He publicly apologized for that crime bill that had these unintended consequences of locking up black men and expanding the criminal justice system. And I think his welfare reform bill, in retrospect, was a welfare deform bill. It took up the social safety net. Now you got women and children falling through it. And so there are a number of things that he's kind of rethinking, and again, certain things he's apologized for that, you know, that were on his watch. You know, certainly the gay and lesbian thing, he's apologized for, you know, being on the wrong side of that question. So, you know, time has us doing strange and interesting dances. So I just hope that in this moment we will. That's a long answer to a very beautiful and short question on your part, but I'm hoping that in the midst of all this madness, that we can find our moorings, find our bearings, and get this thing figured out. If that makes any sense at all.
The new book is The Covenant with Black America, 10 Years Later. It is compiled and edited by Tavis Smiley, our guest this morning. Does Black Lives Matter as a movement have legs to work on many of the issues that we have addressed this morning?
I hope so. I hope so. We're back to that assessment I offered earlier, that everything starts with a moment. It builds momentum, and the momentum turns into a movement. So I'd like to think that that there's some sustaining power there. What I'm heartened by more than anything else is that these are young people, that these are young people whose lives have been so politically marginalized, they've been so economically exploited, they've been so socially manipulated, that they've come to their senses, and they've decided that they want their lives to have meaning and value, and so they've stepped up. The Bible that I read, not to proselytize, says, and a child shall lead them. And so maybe it's the children that are going to lead us out of this. As I think about it, maybe that's not just a biblical admonition, Joe, because there is no social movement that comes to my mind in the history of the world that did not at its apex have the involvement and the engagement and, quite frankly, the leadership of young people. You think of Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement, it's those kids in Birmingham. When Bull Connor turned those hoses and dogs on those kids, the kids who walked out of school that day and were harmed and maimed and killed by Bull Connor, that changed the movement. Go to South Africa, Soweto, Mandela's Nation, that changed the movement. Go to Tiananmen Square in China, and the young kid laying down in front of the tank, that changed the conversation about human rights in China. No movement in the world at its apex did not have the involvement or engagement of young people, and so I'm hoping that the Black Lives Matter movement will have the kind of impact going forward that it's already had to date.
We can ask this question about the issue of guns, of how can you have children shot in their school and not have that lead to an immediate movement. We can ask that about the black kids who were shot by police in municipalities
right.
throughout this country. And while that has started, and for those moments, as you say, of how the movement has not become stronger immediately.
That's why I always say that I am I'm a prisoner of hope. I'm not an optimist. Optimism suggests that there's a particular set of facts, circumstances, conditions, something you can see, feel, or touch that gives you reason to believe that things are going to get better, and so you say, I'm an optimist. Well, that's not the street that I live on, Joe. I am, though, a prisoner of hope. I believe that you can build a whole life on hope, but I believe that in these days, in these times, that even hope needs help. But I remain hopeful. I remain hopeful because I believe at our core, at our very best, our humanity always points us in the right direction. And for those of us who care about this country and who see that poverty is threatening our very democracy, who see that poverty is a matter of national security, who see that on so many political, economic, and social issues, we are witnessing the, how might I put this, the decay of our civilization, the devolution of our culture. You see it happening in front of you. And if we care about this country and care about the future of this country and care about those babies, black, white, red, brown, and yellow, who are not even born yet, then we have to accept the fact that the eyes of the future are looking back at us and hoping and praying that we figure this out, that we get this right. So again, I'm not an optimist, but I'm eternally a prisoner of hope, and that's what keeps me going, even with the list you've just laid out that shows that we don't have courage when it comes to gun control. If they can kill babies, and not just babies, let me be frank about it, when they can kill white babies right. in a school and nothing gets done, we got a problem, brother. We have a real problem. And so I just try to remain a prisoner of hope and do what you do every day, which is try to empower people with information that can help them make better decisions, better choices, and try to live better lives.
So let's end here, because you use this beautiful quote from Frederick Douglass in the book, if there is no struggle, there is no progress, leading to the question, just how much struggle do you have to have?
It's an open question, brother. It is an open question. I will say this, that at some point, if we don't see the light, then we're going to feel the heat. But by one way or another, we're going to have to get moving to redeem, as Dr. King might say, as we approach his holiday in a matter of days from now. We got to redeem the soul of America. It falls the responsibility, it falls the lot of many of us to do our part to help redeem the soul of this country. And I hope that the covenant 10 years later in some small way will help us begin that conversation and engage that work.
The book is beautiful. It's The Covenant with Black America 10 Years Later. It's compiled and edited by Tavis Smiley. Tavis, it's always a pleasure and an honor to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
My great delight, Joe, to be with you always. Thank you for the time, sir.
Thank you very much. Again, The Covenant with Black America, compiled and edited by Tavis Smiley. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.